Mark's been a high-performing skier, a lawyer, a designer, change maker, a kayaker, volunteer, blogger, and much more, with astounding accomplishments in every one of those endeavors. While many service-based volunteers have some element of the activist or spiritual seeker in them, Mark is a staunch atheist who has spent daytime hours defending oil companies and still putting in longer nighttime hours serving than most people. While many feel service as a calling of the heart, Mark's friends all joke that his heart is closer to his stomach, and yet his dedication and clarity is difficult to rival. He's a live wire, a joy-seeking missile, and a thoughtful provocateur who embodies the principles of a world citizen seeking to leave the planet better than he found it. Though Mark would vigorously deny this, we're fortunate to have him as a guest on the call. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
I mean, I not only deny that, I deny like 87% of that introduction.
Great. I'm happy to dig into it with you. I kind of want to, there's so much ground to cover with you, Mark, but I kind of want to start at the in the middle, or, you know, at the service space era, and then jump around a little bit. I know that by the time you encountered charity-focused service space, you had already volunteered with lots of organizations and had been civically involved for quite a long time, since early childhood. What was it that you saw in that first meeting that kind of led you to want to get involved?
With service space, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the story, for those who don't know it, is at the very, very first new volunteer orientation meeting for Charity Focus, which was held down at the Sun Microsystems campus, which is where we used to meet. My partner, Yumi, who most of you know, and who is the real service goddess, she had seen a notice in Craigslist for it, and she wanted to go. So I drove her down. I took my mountain bike, and I, while she was in the meeting, I was up pedaling the hills of the peninsula. There's some great single track trail up there. And I came down to pick her up, and I had had a fantastic day. I mean, I'd had the kind of day that Audrey described in her in the circle of sharing. I mean, it was just perfect in every possible way. And I picked Yumi up at the Sun Microsystems campus after the first meeting. And she says, "You've got to meet these kids." And I soon realized, as she's telling the story of this, the genesis of Charity Focus, which is really happening right then and there, that I had had the second best day in our car. And so the next time, the next Charity Focus meeting, we offered to have it at our house in San Francisco, and I was a CF forever since.
So what was it that you saw about in that early meeting that really grabbed you and made you want to volunteer?
Well, you know, like so many people who've been involved in service space over the years, the thing that attracted me was something that I didn't really understand in a true and comprehensive way until much later, which is this the fairly radical philosophy of service that drives service space. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, I was doing all kinds of volunteer work, both formal and informal. I mean, I was teaching remedial math and reading, and doing high school math tutoring at the local Boys and Girls Club. I was leading neighborhood tree plantings and garbage pickups and this kind of thing. But even from the very beginning, Nipun and Ashish and Trishna and Viral were able to articulate a philosophy of service that was really new, different, and radical. And it was attractive even in the way that we understood it, or I understood it at the time, which was really in terms of slogans and sound bites and maxims. You know, all of us who've come to service space have our light bulb moment, our aha moment, when these wonderful slogans, these wonderful essentialized phrases that come to represent the philosophy suddenly make sense in a very subtle yet palpable way. And, you know, like everyone else, much of what attracted me to service space wasn't something that I can honestly say I understood for quite some time. You know, Nipun is a rare genius, and one of his gifts is the ability not only to think in a subtle way, but to synthesize those thoughts in a way that is attractive and appealing to everyone. And that's why we have kind of this really wonderful service space jargon. These slogans, these maxims, these sound bites that really encapsulate the philosophy so perfectly that that it can kind of resonate in everyone. But I found, and most people I know intimately, who've been involved in service space have found that it's really only after some time of really wrestling with these ideas that we really understand them powerfully and in the full richness of their subtlety, and why service space is so radically different than every other organization out there that's dealing in kindness and generosity and service. And I'm glad to say that there are more and more of them. I mean, it's really a movement that we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years. But you know, there's something different and beautiful and really, you know, fundamentally transgressive about service space that appealed to me.
Mm. Do you have a story about of a moment or a particular slogan that crystallized in a way that made all of what service space was doing kind of clear and real and alive for you?
Sure. I mean, it's sort of like you know, where were you when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, for those of us who are old enough. You know, I was in my office. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And Nipun and Ashish and I were on a call. And our objective was to crystallize everything that we had thought and done and felt about Charity Focus into what we called guiding principles. And, you know, the dynamic between Ashish and Nipun in those early days was really quite fascinating. I mean, Nipun is his own special genius. But, you know, in the same way that, you know, Socrates needed an Alcibiades or you know, any of the kind of interlocutors that you know, were able to express the Platonic philosophy in a dialogue, Ashish was that perfect foil for Nipun, particularly in the formative days of Charity Focus. And in the process of this three-way dialogue where we were trying to really essentialize and concretize those principles that we felt were most significant and most profoundly guiding the work that we were trying to do and what we were trying to achieve. I mean, that's when my aha moment came. It's when we had to take fuzzy ideas and put them into very precise, meaningful language.
And why did it jump out to you? Why was it something that kind of hit home?
Because when you think that you understand something, when you're able to talk the talk for so long, And all of a sudden you realize that you've discovered a whole new level of meaning and subtlety in the message. It's not the kind of thing that you forget. You know, it's very, very easy for us to repeat slogans that we hear repeatedly, particularly when they're attractive and when they resonate with us. But it's another thing to have really pondered them and internalized them and made them our own and understood them in their full complexity, the difficult aspects as well as the easy resonant aspects. You know, one example I give of that, should I start being controversial right off the top of the call, Rahul?
Sure, go for it.
Surprised it hasn't it's taken this long, Mark.
I know. I'm you know, it's Saturday morning. I'm slacking. Okay. I live part of each year in India, and many of you on the call are of Indian descent, if not Indian birth. That is to say, born on the soil of India. And India is a very interesting place. Is this call breaking up? I'm hearing stuff.
Yeah, I can hear you still.
Okay. Yeah, India is a very interesting place.
Mark, if you hold on just one second. For those of you that are on the call, unfortunately, we can't manually mute all of you at the moment. So if you're a participant listening in the call, if you could mute yourself, that'd be great. So that way we can hear Mark clearly. Thank you. Sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
Okay. India is a very interesting place. Okay, remember, the context of this story is this notion that we're very good at spewing maxims and repeating language that we've heard, particularly when it resonates with us in a profound way, even though we may not really understand it at a deep level. And the idea, the context for this story is moving from being able to say the slogans to really understanding them at a profound and transformative, personally transformative level. So the example I'm going to use is India. India has a long and vibrant and very proud history of spirituality, spiritual text, and spiritual practice. And yet, like Deepak Chopra, I maintain that India is the least spiritual place on earth. Actually, he doesn't maintain that. I maintain it's the least spiritual place on earth. He merely says it's not a spiritual place. And the reason I say that is, you know, India has been speaking the language of spirituality for thousands of years. The slogans are well imprinted on every Indian mind, you know, from childhood through repetition and through the fact that these sound bites are given, you know, a degree of cultural primacy. The fact of the matter is, nobody lives like that. You can see in India the fact that nobody lives these slogans which they spew with such alacrity. They've learned to value them because at some level they resonate, and yet nobody lives that way. So to go back to my point with service space, you know, the basic ideas that we're able to encapsulate in these wonderful catchphrases, they resonate with all of us, and because they're beautiful. But it's just the nature of service. It's the nature of gratitude. It's the nature of giving that it's not as easy as a slogan. It takes a while of practice to really internalize these on an intellectually significant level and really a level that's significant for the kind of personal transformation that we talk about in service space.
Mm. So it sounds like you're saying that what you kind of saw was that people were really walking their talk and digesting it sort of from the inside out in a way that really added a lot of weight to slogans.
I think about the beauty of service space is that people can participate at all kinds of levels, and it's all
integrity.
Good. Yeah, people can participate at all kinds of levels of depth in service space, and it's all good and it's all transformative. I mean, even if a person was inspired by, say, the content of Daily Good or calls like these, to just go out and do one good thing, and good being whatever they feel is good. And if they felt personally virtuous for having done that, I mean, that's kind of at odds with the transgressive radical philosophy of service space. But you know what? It's still all good, because one more good thing has been done in the world. I mean, that's kind right. of the service space for beginners level of participation. You know, start by getting involved with your community. Start by doing one good act. But, you know, when you get to the level of an Ashish Metta or a Nipun Metta or a Viral Metta, what we can call the Metta level of service. I used to joke that I either know far too many people named Metta, or considering who they are, far too many. In any event, when you get to the deeper level, you start to understand the philosophy not in traditional terms of virtue, not even in terms of beneficiary and the beneficiary of service and the giver of service. These kind of notions, which are incredibly traditional in all kinds of cultures, in Western culture, back to the Greeks as far back as the pre-Socratics, and farther back than that, in terms of you find it in Old Testament literature, you find it in some recounting of ancient Egyptian culture, you see it in Asian cultures. This idea of the perfection of virtue, it's hard to move from that model to an understanding of service as a tool of personal transformation, and personal transformation as a tool of global transformation. Radically different way of understanding service. And frankly, it takes all of us time to get to that in a way that we can both wrap our heads around intellectually and in a way that is like deeply resonant.
Right.
Hi, can I request everyone to please mute themselves, because we're having some problems with the console? Except for Rahul and Mark, of course.
Okay. So, Mark, you know, one thing that's clear about you and also is, I guess, both fed and derived from your career as a lawyer, is that you just have this incredibly powerful talent for communicating and clarifying concepts. And it's one of those skills that kind of has helped organizations scale and become effective in their mission. And at the same time, Service Space is one of these organizations that's never strived for scale, and in fact talked about the power of small as one of its kind of pillar core values. So I was curious about how you think about and understand the concept of small acts, and in particular how you see the dynamic of that relating to your talent around kind of mass communication at scale.
Yeah. Let me take the first part of the question first, the small act question.
Okay.
I mean, you would not believe the number of times each month, I mean, and, you know, sometimes of the year, each week, that I get asked, I love what you do in your life, you know, that you've been able to go off and live a life of service. I wish I could do that, but, you know, I want to do something. Can you help me understand how I'm going to do it? And I said, well, you know, tell me what your passions are. Tell me what your interests are. Tell me what talents that you have that you think you'd like to exploit, you know, and then I can help you. And they say, you know, things, like, you know, gee, I really want to cure cancer, or, you know, I really want to find a cause, you know, a way for peace in the Middle East, or, you know, or you know, I really want to feed all the people who are hungry or house all the people who are homeless. And I look at them and I say, you know, that's all great, but that's not good. That's not going to help you, and it's not going to help them. You know, one friend who, she and her buddy in Bombay, every morning they pull on their track suits and they go out for a walk in their park, in this little park by the house, the apartment building where they live. I said, you know, every morning you go out for a walk with your friend. Tomorrow, you do a lap around the park, you say goodbye to your friend, and do one more lap around your park. Only this time, you know, pick up all the trash that you see around that route. And she said, no, that's not what I want to do. I mean, you know, I want to feed all the hungry kids in Bombay. So, well, you're not going to be able to do that, and it's going to frustrate you, and it's not going to help them. And it's going to be overwhelming, and you're just going to quit. And that's not a philosophical matter. That's just a practical matter. Start small. Start by picking up the trash where you walk. And she said, first of all, I can't do that because what will people think? And second of all, I mean, what good does that do? And I said, precisely because people will think it odd that a, you know, a fancy-ass lady like you is picking up trash in the park, absolutely, they'll think it's odd. But you know what? They'll think about it.
Mark, what are some of the things that you do?
Well, it is one of the things that I do, but that's neither here nor there. It will be inspiring. And if one other person acts on it, you will have made a huge change in the world. And if no one acts on it, and yet their hearts were gladdened by seeing you do it, you will have made a change in the world. And if nobody's hearts were gladdened by it, but even one person stopped to think, gee, it's kind of odd and crazy that this, you know, upper class woman is picking up trash in the park in Bombay with her own hands, you will have made a valuable change in the world. And it's something that you can take through the day and feel good about. And it's something that you can build on in terms of your personal service, so that maybe at some point you do have the internal capacity as well as the institutional capacity to start feeding those hungry kids in Bombay that you're concerned about. But right now you have a full-time job. You're not going to go, start an effective organization. So do what you can, because there's great power in the stuff that we can do. How does it scale is a much harder question. And I guess I would look to smile cards and as an example of the very interesting and, again, radically transgressive approach of service space toward getting things like small to scale, right? The challenge in scaling small is that small doesn't scale to big. Small scales to small times many, right?
Mm.
That's the challenge. You know, it's sort of like those old math problems we used to get in high school. You know, what is, when you were doing set theory, you know, what is the, anyway, I won't get into that. But I mean, it's easy to think that small scales to big. And in my example that I gave for that woman, maybe small would scale to bigger projects. But the challenge for an organization like Service Space is that we don't want small to scale to bigger or even to big. We want small to scale to small times the whole world, small times many. Because if everybody's out there doing little things, right, there's no, the big things kind of disappear. And right. I think smile cards are a great example of the way that Service Space deals with trying to scale small, and that is with creativity and with fun and with joy. I mean, I have to tell you, the best thing I've heard on this call this morning, and there hasn't been much good on the call this morning, mostly because I've been talking the whole time, but was Audrey sharing. And, you know, the story that Audrey told was a great story. I guess it came from the Wednesday. But the thing that was absolutely awesome about Audrey's sharing was not the story she told, but the lesson that she took from it, which was, you know, it's about creativity, and it's about joy, and it's about fun. It's whether, you know, whether you're a...
Sure. So, you know, when I first met Mark, he was actually, this is probably back in 2003, he was a high-powered lawyer who was partner in his own firm with a penthouse office overlooking the San Francisco Bay. And what's interesting is that that wasn't the first thing that I would have felt about him at all. There was no sense of intimidation. I was sort of instantly put at ease by him. And then the next, I think one of the early times that I also got together with him was at his place, which was a converted warehouse in downtown San Francisco that he was his home, but that he'd also converted into a community space that had a sound stage and a lot of fancy lighting and audio equipment that he used to routinely host musicians and local video and musical and classical performances. And so he was, what I got early on was that, you know, here's a guy of just astounding contrast, you know, and at the same time, a thoughtful insight into all of those contrasting aspects of life. Are you
I'm back,
Mark?
Yep, sorry.
Oh, okay.
You guys got lucky. You missed, as boring as that was, you missed even the most boring part of it.
No worries.
That's okay. Rahul was giving us background on, you know, why you are the way that you are.
Huh?
I don't think I myself know the answer, but Mark, one thing I wanted to touch on, you know, you've talked about living in India half the year, and it seems like you have some sort of special connection with India. How do you think about the place, especially given that you talk about it as such an unspiritual, you know, non-spiritual place that doesn't live its values? It's kind of interesting that you choose to spend half the year there. So how do you process its kind of place in your life, its purpose in your life, if any?
Oh, sure. Well, the fact that India is a non-spiritual place fits easily with me because I'm like the most spiritually vacuous person you've ever met. I mean, I don't even have a soul. That's how kind of trouble I'm in. So that actually doesn't bug me that much. People always assume, I mean, look, I live in India half the year. I even live in an ashram town. I live in Pondicherry, home to the Sri Aurobindo Ashram with Auroville 10 clicks up the road. And people just kind of naturally assume that I'm a spiritual seeker, which always cracks me up. I disabuse them of that pretty quick. But the question is a good one, and it's always the same, why India? And the flippant answer I give is that India is endlessly engaging. The things that are wonderful about India are many and really interesting. And the things that are fucked up about India are downright fascinating. So there's never a dull moment in India. And, you know, that's just how I feel about the place. I feel very lucky to live in a community of really smart, engaged, funny, joyful people who kind of see the world the way I do and are engaged in service. And, you know, that makes it nice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely an aching for India when I've been in North America for too long. But there's that time every spring when, you know, it's just such a pain in the butt to mail a letter that it's also time to leave.
Right.
To Mark, I just, you know, while I have an opportunity here, I guess, as well. I mean, how did you even end up in Auroville or Pondicherry just along your journey? I mean, in the first place, and then going from that to being there, you know, half the year.
Quite by accident, Amit. In fact, My first trips to India, I had no desire to go anywhere near Pondicherry or Oroville. But a friend of mine and an old CF person, Supriya Srinivasan, was doing her Arangetram in Bharatanatyam with her guru in Chennai. So I was retiring as a lawyer and setting off to live a life of service. And so heading back to India was probably on the cards anyway, but since Sips was doing her Arangetram in Madras, instead of flying north as I normally would, I had scheduled my flight to go south. This is in the my flight to India was the 31st of December, 2004. So that was technically my last day as a lawyer. And 5 days before was the Indian Ocean tsunami. And even in San Francisco, I was inundated with phone calls from my friends in North India asking if I could help make connections for them in South India, because they knew I had connections in both parts of the country for tsunami relief. I happened to land in Madras, and on the 1st of January was the first NGO coordination, maybe it was the 2nd of January, the first NGO coordination meeting. And I met a fellow from Oroville who had a project that Yumi and I seemed suited for, and he invited us down. We had a friend who had an empty apartment in Pondicherry, and boom, the tsunami washed us to Pondicherry. It was quite accidental, and there we fell in with this amazing community of service folks.
Hey Mark, it's Trishna. I just wanted to say
Hey,
hi. I'm sorry, I
Trishna.
dialed onto the call a little late. I was
Oh, you missed all the
sorting
good
out
stuff.
Serena stuff, but I just wanted to say hi. It's good to hear from you and see you on the forest call. Since I missed the
Great.
first part, I just wanted.
I actually have an answer to that question.
To...
The question Trishna asks is a good one, and here's the answer. Trishna is one of the most amazing people I have ever met, and absolutely one of the daily, and this is not an exaggeration, daily inspirations for me to serve. I met Trishna when she was about 12. She was just graduated, or maybe not even graduated yet, from Berkeley, and already possessed one of the finest organizational minds of any person I have ever met. And for those of you who've come to service space in recent years and wonder how this incredible philosophy that blossomed largely from the brain of Nipun, with lots of bounce back help and fine tuning from people like Ashish and Viral and Pavi and Guri. If any of you wonder how that spun into such an amazingly tight organizational structure, the person that you really ought to look to first and foremost is Trishna Shah.
Wait a minute. I was getting on the call to talk to you. How did you turn the tables?
Interesting.
And in fact, the question I was going to ask you, since I haven't been in touch in recent kind of couple years, I guess, is I was just curious what's currently kind of your biggest source of inspiration for what you've been involved with, which I'm sure you talked about earlier and I missed, but it'd be interesting to know at least what the source of your inspiration is at the moment.
My source of inspiration continues to be actually another tremendous service-based leader and absolutely paragon of volunteerism, and that's Yumi Lee.
Of course.
For those of you who don't know Yumi, you really ought to take the time. Every day she is absolutely the perfect model of selflessness and service. And going way back to our earliest notions of collective volunteerism, you know, back in the early days of Charity Focus, before we had 1,000 different programs, and we were working on, you know, really complicated aspects of gift economy and of gratitude and generosity, we were really toying in interesting experimental ways with this notion of collective volunteerism, the power of volunteerism when it's not just me going out and doing something, but when I not only do something, but that act of doing, because it happens in community, empowers other people to act also. In other words, my act of volunteerism not only creates a good in the world, but it creates a secondary and maybe more important good in that it gives someone else also the opportunity to volunteer or to participate in a collective act of service. And Yumi Lee is absolutely the paragon of that model.
I could agree more. Thanks, Mark.
Actually, Mark just answered my question. My question was, I know Yumi also volunteers with Service Space and what it has meant for the partnership, which I think he answered. And I think Mariette has a question about the partnership as well. So go for it, Mariette.
So, Mark, following up on Yumi, I was curious to hear how the two of you met and how that experience was.
Ah, hi, Mariette. Yumi and I met in college. Actually, we probably met on the first day of classes my freshman year. She was a year older than I. We took intensive Russian. And so we met in Russian class, and we were buddies for several years before we became an item. But basically, you know, she was just so into me that at some point I couldn't resist, and, you know, the rest is history. That was about 35 years ago.
Well, for those of you that have met Yumi, you'll realize it was probably the other way around.
Oh, that's so not true. For those of you who have met Yumi, you know that she has never done anything in her life that she didn't want to do. So the thought that I could have compelled her into the relationship is absolutely silly. I mean, the chick was into me. What could I say?
That's great. I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hey, Mark, this is Vinyam. I had so many questions in my mind, but you're so funny, and just your share is so beautiful that I kind of got lost. So,
my sister, you're the only person on earth that thinks I'm funny.
Trust me, there are many people who think that. So I'm one of the, you know, new Service Space entrants. Just got into Service Space a few months ago by good fortune, and it's just so beautiful to hear all your stories about the genesis of Service Space and how it all came together. And you said such beautiful things, and it resonated so deeply with me. And one thing I quickly wanted to say before I ask you my question is, you spoke about how, you know, people have these big ideas of wanting to change the world, and it really starts with those small acts. And I just found myself thinking, oh gosh, I was one of those people who wanted to change systems and huge things, and it really helped to hear that from you. It gave me a lot of, it gave a lot of connection. So my question to you is, you know, there's a lot of talk, obviously, about you being an atheist, and I know you are. How do you find what is your support system, your internal support system? What grounds you and what gives you strength?
Okay. So I think the most important fact about humans is that we're moral agents. And I think the most important thing for us to be in some way that I can't trace the origin of it, because frankly, metaphysics and epistemology aren't that interesting to me. I mean, I understand they're the big questions, you know, capital T, capital B, capital Q. But to me, ethics are interesting. And to me, what's important is to be the most effective moral agent I can be. And that means not following rules and prescriptions for good behavior. It means thinking about what right behavior means for me and acting accordingly. And so, you know, from I don't need it's not part of my worldview to require an answer to the big questions in order to live a moral life and make decisions that I think make me an effective moral agent. And, you know, I mean, maybe I'm an atheist because it's just not essential to how I live my life to be able to answer the big questions. Of course, the real reason I'm an atheist is that there's no God, but, you know, it's possible that that other explanation also exists.
You know, Mark,
that was a joke. See, that's a perfect example.
Okay.
My sister would have laughed at that. I'm just saying.
You know, for a guy who's an atheist, you kind of have an awful lot of friends that are spiritual friends. And
right.
I know you've previously spoken and blogged about
that's
this.
That's so ugly. I know. I mean, you're judged by the company you keep, but I can't help it. You know, a lot of you folks are real interesting.
You've previously spoken and blogged about the vague indefinability of spirituality, and Rahul has said that you had some kind of an experience at Cornell Library that perhaps defies the traditional explanation. So I was hoping you could share a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, I know what he's talking about. So this is the out-of-body experience thing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was studying legal philosophy at the London School of Economics, and that's an old school in the middle of urban London in old buildings, and each student in sort of like American high schools, each student has a locker somewhere in the complex, and mine was down in the basement. In an old boiler room. And there was something about that place that used to trigger out-of-body experiences for me. And they were wonderful. And I could, with, you know, daily practice, I could make them last even hours. They always kind of disappeared, sort of like a cartoon thought bubble, as soon as I arrived back at my flat. But I could wander the city for hours and hours as is typically described, quote, being out of my body and really being a third party observer to myself. And I have no explanation for it whatsoever, but I don't necessarily think that that the explanation tends toward the spiritual, even though all my spiritual friends see that as inevitable. I just think it's a mystery. It was such a wonderful thing. I have to say, I once had, I was flying to Africa and I had a 4-hour layover in London, and I hightailed it onto the tube downtown, knocked on the doors of the LSE. It was a Sunday morning. I got a janitor to let me in and convinced him to let me back down into that boiler room to see if I could, re-trigger the thing, but no dice. Didn't work.
Hi, Mark. This is Gayatri here.
Hey, Gayatri.
Still cherish your compliment and much gratitude for all your pro-poor stories. Beautiful stories. The question for you was: India is facing such huge garbage disposal problems. Probably the root cause of it could be, you know, the lack of understanding spirituality in its core. So my question was, do you see any light for India, you know, in terms of this? Also because the superficial spirituality is so deep-rooted.
It's an excellent question. Yeah, it's a superb question. I've actually written a bunch about this. I wrote an essay called about the Kumbh Mela called "The Shit of the Saintly Is Still Reeking."
Yeah, I remember that.
And
I also remember your story on the train, which I just can't, you know, keep sharing, stop myself from sharing it with everybody that I meet.
The train story. For those of you who don't know, I work in garbage, and I used to at least write a lot about garbage.
Oh, really? Okay.
If you look under trash on my blog, you'll find a bunch of it. Here's the thing. I absolutely relate the garbage problem in India to what I call a lack of spirituality. And I don't think spirituality is necessarily important, since I don't litter and I'm not spiritual. But I do think that it points to hypocrisy. And I think what it really shows is that for the most part, on the main, Indians do not see themselves as effective moral agents, or individual moral agency is so well defined by ritual and
reverence
and tradition that it allows really appalling behavior. It's the difference between people keeping their homes absolutely immaculately and throwing their trash out onto the street for someone else to pick up. It's the difference between personal hygiene, which is practiced on a level which is so minutely ritualized and so intense, and the utter lack of communitarian values and the practicing of public hygiene. Now, do I see hope in this? I do. I see great hope, and I'll give you two examples. You know how sociologists often use these twins separated at birth, and experimental psychologists. They use these twins separated by at birth experiments to try and understand whether some personal characteristic is nurture or nature in origin. I would suggest that the perfect Indian separated at birth experiment shows that the Indian attitude toward poor public hygiene is completely learned and not innate. So India was born at midnight on, what was it, August something, 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 something.
August 15th, 1947.
Right.
There you go. and at the same hour, Pakistan was born. And it is the same country. These were literally twins separated at birth. Now, look, much of Pakistan is an absolute shithole. But if you look at the Punjab, which was split, and you look at Lahore, that city is immaculate. I mean, you could eat off the streets. The boulevards are planted with fresh annual flowers. The canals are cleaned every year. Kids swim in there. Animals. In Lahore. Now, why is Lahore just the model of public hygiene, and no place in India is the model of public hygiene? It's because it taught itself to be that way, and India can teach itself to have deeper communitarian values, and I don't mean communitarian in the ugly way that we're used to using it in India, which is, you know, religious intolerance. I mean seeing yourself as part of something greater and acting as an effective moral agent. And for those of us who live in North America, you know, if we think that that's not possible, just think back, for those of us who are old enough, to what the trash situation was like in America back in the 1970s. There's a great, what I'll call an Indian example, although that's kind of a pun.
Okay,
The thing that started to change the trash situation in America was a commercial, a public service announcement that first aired in 1973 to celebrate the first anniversary of Earth Day. And it was this iconic commercial of a kind of a iconic figure of an American Indian paddling
the
a
Red
bird.
Indian, right? The Red Indian who has tears in his eyes when he...
Exactly. He's paddling his birch bark polluted river, and he's standing by the side of the highway. Somebody throws...
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
And the commercial ends with a tear rolling down his cheek. Now, that should make us think back to a time when America was a disaster as far as garbage. People thought nothing of throwing their trash on the street. And yet, in a few short decades, the landscape radically transformed. It's not perfect, but, compared to India, the U.S. looks like Switzerland. So these things can be taught, and attitudes will change. But what we need is our change agents and programs for change.
Yeah, thank you. I think the technical difficulty continues. Hey, Mark, in the theme of looking at life as a play and a fun, and I have a feeling that, you scored really high in the whole conversation. And I must say, thanks to Rahul for steering the conversation. That's incredible. And I have a feeling that I think we're just warming up here. This can't be it. I wanted to share one quick reflection because I missed the early opening. Last week we and I follow it up with a quick question. I know we are, keeping in the.
Hey, we just have a few minutes, Prakash. So
a few minutes.
I'm going to ask you to maybe choose one or the other.
I'll try to do the both. How about that? It'll be quick. The question first, Mark. I was thinking maybe if you could give a little bit of sneak peek into your community around. We're really eager to know your current community. And the second part of that is, what are you learning now? And the quick reflection was, following along the theme of the seeds, I think last week we had this beautiful occasion to meet Kanchan and Peter, who came all the way from Portland to be with the community here. We didn't get a chance to have a lot of conversation, but I learned so much just by being around the gentle presence of Peter and Kanchan's getting things done attitude. That was so beautiful. And while we were there, Sadipa's friends got these awesome organic, locally gleaned plums. And as a mark of gratitude to these two beautiful beings, Kanchan and Peter, quite naturally, all those seeds were collected, and slowly, one by one, in so many different open spaces, the plum seeds are being, put to use, and really looking forward for all the ripples the possibility of those ripples. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, I think I can answer more briefly than that. What am I learning? I really don't know. And I think I don't know because the way my life kind of works, there's great continuity in my life. Even when I start new projects or enter new sectors that I've never, been involved with before, whether it's biotechnology or learning to play tennis or whatever. I just don't mark time that way in my life. When I turned 50 a few years ago, I wrote that I feel the same as I did when I was 40 and when I was 30 and I was 20. And part of that may be that, my knees were shot at the time I was 20. So I'm just as, I was no more decrepit now than I was when I was your age. But by the same token, I hope I retain some of that Audrey spirit that I talked about earlier. And maybe that means that the highs are high, but, every day is full of highs. I mean, this call was something I was so not looking forward to. I mean, that devil Kanchan made me do this. And, but it's turned out to be nice to hear from all of you. No lows are too low, and the days are so filled with highs that you know, it doesn't really mark time for me. And so I think the fact that I can't really point to what I'm learning is really a function of continuity. You know, just kind of a constant gratitude, I guess.
That's great, Mark. You know, I'm going to wrap up with one last question, and then we will sign off on the call. But you've had a massive number of serious injuries, but I, you know, from what I hear, it never seems to get you down. And so I guess, how do you personally process your own suffering, and how does it affect the way that you think about suffering of others?
Oh, it's an excellent question, because suffering's an important topic. I mean, I'm not a religious person, as I think you all know, but have tremendous respect for the Buddhist tradition, which is kind of amazing because I think it's a tradition that's founded on, I mean, its fundamental premise is 100% wrong. And I think it's amazing that you could create an essentially excellent religion based on a false premise. And that premise is that life is suffering. You know, my father once asked me, he said, you know, you spend so much time on crutches and in casts. You know, why do you do the crazy things you do? Why do you jump off the cliffs that you jump off of? You know, I was a downhill ski racer. You know, why do you do this crazy stuff? And I said to him, you know, look, if I had perfect foresight, if I knew every moment of pain and inconvenience and suffering that I would endure as a result of being a sports person, I would choose to do it anyway, because it's worth it to me. Because that way of expressing myself is so much a part of who I am. It's such a joy-producing thing that, you know, that's a trade-off I would gladly make. You know, I got smashed by a car pretty well when I was riding my bike to work back in 2000. And I was in the hospital. I had a huge brain injury, and I mean, not every bone in my body, but a lot of them were broken. I mean, I was a mess. I looked like hell. And people would come to my hospital room where I was on my morphine drip, and they would say to me, you know, you are so lucky. And what they meant was, you're so lucky to be alive. And I'd look at them and I would say, no, you know, being dead was never really an issue for me. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to die. But I can kind of consider this to be the unluckiest thing that ever happened to me. I don't know how you can consider me lucky. I mean, look at me. I'm a mess. This was an unlucky thing. So it's really a function of perspective. And understanding that, you know, we are our bodies. Our bodies are, you know, they break, but the coolest thing about them is that they mend themselves. I mean, homeostasis is just about the coolest fact in all of science. And so, you know, if you understand that part of the entry fee, part of the payment for playing is the wrist injury, you know, you think, wow, that's an okay trade-off. I mean, that's the way I look at it.